talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before I go any further, I want to thank Glenn Hatchell, who hosted last Wednesday in my absence while I was in California and did a great job delivering a truly stellar show. Part of what I was doing during my week in California, by the way, was attending an international conference on captive wildlife held in Burbank once every 4 years. It was really impressive, the best one I've been to, reflecting a much broader global scope, including speakers from Japan, Zimbabwe, Australia, Brazil, Serbia, and many other countries. The talks and the panels were uniformly stellar, and I don't just say that because I was privileged to moderate three panels. The conference devoted an entire day to captive elephants, but there was also considerable attention paid to captive orcas and dolphins, captive big cats and captive bears, among other animals, and also the science of captivity. For example, a neuroscientist discussed the impact of being held in confined spaces on tiger brains, and so on. In the coming weeks and months, I hope to interview some of those speakers and panelists right here on Talking Animals. As for today, my guest is Dr. Nick Pyonson, the curator of fossil marine mammals at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. Pyonson is also the author of Spying on Whales, the Past, Present, and Future of Earth's Most Awesome Creatures, in which he engages in prodigious surveillance of the whale world, presenting a time-traveling expedition that's absorbing at every stop. Across the pages of the book, Pyonson projects a passion for whales and research in them that extends well beyond paleontology. Indeed, he recounts undertaking multiple efforts that had no particular fossil focus. We'll hear about whale bones, living whales, and about him when I speak with Dr. Nick Pyonson in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Don Goldstein, our longtime Greyhound correspondent, in our first conversation since Amendment 13 passed. We'll ask Don to offer a brief post-13 assessment, especially mindful that there seems to be doubt, confusion, and misinformation about what will happen to all the Greyhounds as racing is phased out by 2020. Right now, though, let's get to Dr. Pyonson with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Nick Pyonson on Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Dr. Pyonson.
Hi, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, and congratulations on the book, which has earned all kinds of rave reviews and other accolades, and definitely part of the Pro Pyonson squad. I'm a fan of the book and eager to discuss it, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, I'd like to find out a bit more about you, especially as it may provide context for the work that you do and the book that you wrote. So I guess we almost have to start with, when did you first become interested in fossils, in bones?
Oh, I think that was an early interest ever since childhood. I was lucky enough as a kid to have parents that took me to natural history museums. And I realized very early on that those were places that had so much wonder in them. There are these great big halls with giant skeletons of, in many cases, animals that have been extinct for hundreds, millions of years. So that really was, I guess, a formative experience. That I thought museums were cool places, and I kind of understood what they were about. Now, it took me my whole life to get back to working in a museum, but that's kind of an early inspiration for me.
For sure. Well, yeah, that sounds like a journey that the seed was planted quite young. So along those lines, were you, as you went to those kind of museums, were you intrigued by dinosaurs and dinosaur bones as a kid, as many kids are?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I think dinosaur bones, mammoth bones, whale bones, they're all bones that are larger than a kid is tall. in many cases. So that has a way of captivating, I think, a lot of people's imagination, and certainly mine, that it was, there are animals that are no longer here in some cases. They can't hurt you, and they're amazing. So I think that leads to all sorts of questions that you might want to ask. And if you're a scientist, in many cases, you can answer those questions. You can discover more about those mysteries. And that's still a fundamental aspect of what I do day to day. So my inner child feels very rewarded by my job.
Right. Well, it sounds like you brought the kind of sense of wonder that you described feeling going to those museums when your parents took you to those museums. And that has fueled you to the career path that you pursued and on to right now and beyond. Because there's definitely a sense of a wonder that really permeates the book. I mean, you just seem like you're, as I mentioned in the opening, I mean, you're super passionate about whatever it is that you're doing, whatever aspect of the work that you're doing. But there is kind of more of an implied sense of wonder in what's propelling that.
Yeah, I think that's, I'm glad to hear that comes through in the book. And the subject matter makes that a little easier, given how amazing whales are. They have all these traits that seem fantastic, and I think you can appreciate a bit more about what makes those traits so amazing when you understand how those traits have evolved, where they came from, what the starting points were, and what we're able to know about them today with all sorts of new technology, whether it's drones or suction cup tags that can be placed on the backs of whales. I tried to make the case in the book that we're living in the golden age of whale science, that we know so much more about these mysterious animals. And that's important given how much change is happening to their world and our world.
Well, I obviously want to explore some of that and some of the stuff that you cover in the book that helps underscore, I think, that premise. But just as far as just backing up a little bit, what about whales? Again, you were exposed to all these things at the museums and all kinds of bones of things that were extinct and not extinct. But you seem to gravitate, obviously, towards whales. I think you mentioned in the book that there was at one point some sort of distribution map or something that you saw. And so you realized that the blue whale, the biggest whale, in some ways passed pretty near where you were living, right? The St. Lawrence River. So it seems like that was some sort of key element of this. But what else do you think really captured you about whales versus something else that might have also created that same sense of wonder in you early on?
I think, you know, what I try to communicate in the book was that I had all kinds of interests when I was little. Whales didn't kind of exclusively dominate any one particular
right.
focus or you know, bout of reading. But I kind of came back to whales through a variety of funny coincidences and experiences that I had in college doing field work. You know, whenever you have the opportunity to get out into the world and have an outdoor classroom experience, I think that's really important because it really reminds you that the point of education is to become a lifelong learner, whether the classroom is indoors and formal or outdoors in kind of a more informal setting. That turned out to be, I mean, I kind of understand that nowadays much better because I work in a museum where informal education happens all the time in a variety of ways. And we're still very much learning how to do that in the best ways. But for whales, it was kind of a slow process of getting to understand the questions, how to ask those questions that you could answer about them that really captivated me. And fortunately, I started asking those questions at a point in my development as a scientist where that put me in touch with a variety of people also asking similar questions and also just starting their scientific careers. So I guess I'd say that my social network that really kind of fueled this interest and has helped me, you know, these days science is not a one-person operation. You can't really do science and ask the big questions without collaborators. And so how well you get along with your scientific colleagues determines a lot of your success, I think.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting because another thing that really comes through in the book is you are out in the field or out in the water, as obviously as case may be, but you really talk about or indicate at least a sense of camaraderie when you're out on kayaks or out on some other thing with whatever peers, colleagues, whatever happen to be there with you. So this kind of fits right in with what you're saying about it. It's not an isolated pursuit by a long shot, and it sounds like it really suits you that it is more social.
I really value that aspect because it puts you in contact with people who've had different experiences, who come from different backgrounds in many cases, who also might be asking the same kind of question, but have a different body of knowledge that they that's behind them, that's behind their kind of line of inquiry. And I think that's really important because the best, this is something I try to say in the book, the best questions in science are at the edges of boundaries. What we call disciplines in science or knowledge are just really artificial constructs about how we split up the world out there. But the world out there is way more complex than we really know, and we're trying to understand more about that. So I think whenever you can ask the right question, that puts you in touch with people who have maybe an non-overlapping set of knowledge that can help you get there. It's also, I think, you kind of put your finger on it, it's a lot of fun. I mean,
yeah.
Science should be fun to do. And if it wasn't so much fun, I probably wouldn't be doing it.
Right, for sure. Well, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Nick Pyonson, the curator of fossil marine mammals at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. He's also the author of Spying on Whales, the Past, Present, and Future of Earth's Most Awesome Creatures. If you'd like to ask Dr. Pyonson a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So let's get into the book. Before we delve into specifics, as I kind of already alluded to, I guess, one striking trait of Spying on Whales is that not only talk about you're having fun and you're passionate about really sort of damn near every aspect of whales, right? You're digging for whale bones here, you're kayaking near humpback whale there, and you seem to love these and many other things that you describe in the book with equal ardor. So I just think that's interesting, and we'll maybe circle back to this because I think a lot of people might say, hey, a book by a paleontologist, that's probably a guy who just sort of hangs out in some sort of dusty office and is looking at bones. And again, obviously that's a narrow view, especially as it pertains to you, but I think a lot of people nonetheless might be surprised just how much you are out and about and studying whales that are very much alive and traveling the globe really to do so. So, but first, the book is divided into examining whales by way of past, present, and future. Uh-huh. One element of the past that feels incumbent on us to touch on is where you address the first whales.
Yeah.
Can you describe just at least a little bit about what the first whales were and what they look like?
Sure. I mean, this is, I think this is, these are facts that would surprise a lot of people. Even if you understand that whales are mammals, that they're warm-blooded, that they give birth to live young, they nurse those young, they breathe air. They're mammals just as much as your cat, your dog, or the squirrels outside. But what makes them so different is they live 99% of their lives underwater. And they have all these adaptations for doing that. I mean, the way I said it was, they hardly look like mammals. And the reason for all those incredible traits is their evolutionary history. It goes back over 50 million years ago. So if you went back in time to around 50 million years ago and saw these first whales, they probably would look most similar to a large domestic dog. That's kind of it's striking because whales today don't have hind limbs, for example. So these earliest whales definitely had weight-bearing hind limbs. They had a long tail. They had nostrils at the end of their snout. They probably even had hair, although we don't really know because fur doesn't really fossilize in most cases. And certainly we don't have fur impressions from these earliest whales. So the first whales were land-dwelling. They probably lived near rivers and streams and fed for part of their lives in that kind of environment, if not more swampy environment. And what's amazing from the fossil record of these early whales is that we can actually pinpoint the transformations that go on in their skeleton that make them more and more aquatic over a period of about 10 million years until we see the first fully aquatic whales that no longer have weight-bearing hind limbs, that have a long backbone that probably ended in a tail, that had a skull where the nostrils were retracted further back along the skull. So they were worn at the tip of the nose, but sort of more in line with the eyes. All these transformations we can read from the skeletons in the fossil record, and we can infer what that means for how those earliest whales lived.
Yeah, again, for people, including myself, who were coming to that part of the information kind of anew, it was just sort of striking to think that the whale was on the land, you know, obviously venturing into the water at times, and there's kind of a cool etching, as I recall, somewhere that sort of captures that. But a far cry from anything we would conceive as whale-like now, and just like you say, that the evolution and how that changed. I mean, it represents, you say, 50 million years or so. So it, yeah, you know, it took a while to get there, but I just think that's a striking thing to ponder. And then again, the etching in the book just sort of, it's like, wow, that's a whale. I mean, it's just
yeah.
I got my own sense of wonder going on along the way when in reading the book and seeing some of these images. So
right. So as a paleontologist, what I always think about with the fossil record is how it can tell us things that we wouldn't otherwise know about the history of any lineage. And I think that's certainly true for whales, because you can, if you know whales are mammals, that gets you at least to the point of saying, all right, which of the mammals out there is the most closely related to? And if you look at their DNA, the answer is whales fit in the family tree with cows, deer, pigs, cattle, camels, hippos. And it's pretty clear one of these things is not like the other, and those are whales. So how do we get to that point? And that's where the fossil record really shows us what has happened in the last 50 million years to give us whales as we see them today.
Yeah, well, you know, what you just touched on there, I mean, among the reasons I imagine so many folks have sung the book's praises, and your praises really, is that in addition to these sort of some of the meatier explorations of topics, the book is also chock full of these fascinating tidbits and asides. And one you just, as you were talking there, reminded me is when you note somewhere, it's almost in passing, that hippos are the closest living relatives to whales.
Yeah.
And I just thought, wow, I mean, now that you mention it, it kind of makes sense. But I mean, without prompting, just I don't think I ever would have gotten there on my own.
Yeah. That's a piece of information that comes from what I would call the molecular revolution in biology that happened now over 20 years ago, where we started amassing a lot more genetic data from DNA sequences from which we could actually figure out who was related to whom and create a family tree just from DNA. Now, the big hole in that is that 99% of all life that ever happened on this planet is extinct and doesn't have any DNA sequences to give us.
Mm.
So we have to kind of reconcile where we put in all these fossil branches relative to the living ones that we see on the tree of life represented by DNA.
Yeah.
And that's been a challenge for evolutionary biologists. I mean, this is a lot of ink has been spilled about any animal group when you look at that conflict, if there is one, between what DNA tells us about their history and what the bones tell us. And so that makes it fun, I think, for scientists.
Yeah. Well, there's a gap that you have to sort of travel or figure out how to get between this point, what we think we know or what we do know, and this next point that we're not so sure.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Right. Yeah. And yeah, so that was a real light bulb moment. Another, just again, as far as in the cool, fascinating tidbits and asides, is that at one point you talk about some whales, at least, that can be left or right-handed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm still, again, back to your sense of wonder, I still have a sense of wonder about that and just how that's right. Expressed.
Right. So that information comes from studies that colleagues of mine have published on, where they've used tag data. So by putting a removable suction cup tag on the backs of whales, which is a pretty crazy process when you actually get down to it, but if it's successfully deployed, as they say, that device temporarily on the back of these whales tells us what they're doing underwater, which is something we wouldn't otherwise know. And in many cases, that device records all the same data that our smartphones can do. So we have little accelerometers inside our smartphones, and those tell us position of your phone, not just GPS, but also XYZ, how fast your phone is moving. That same kind of instrumentation is put in these little devices on the backs of whales, and that can tell us what the whale, how the whale's moving underwater, and especially in relation to whatever it's feeding on. I mean, that's really where it gets interesting, because otherwise you just get a lot of data about how the whales are moving, swimming, but when you collect information about how whales are feeding, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where you really understand how the organism interacts with its environment, what its ecology is like. That's where we start to answer these questions we have as scientists studying whales. And so as it turns out, for at least some species of whales, as they approach these swarms of prey, krill, small fish, they will tend to turn in one direction or another. And that when you have the same device deployed on the back of a whale over several hours, and the whale's in a place where they're feeding a lot, you get a lot of data about these lunges each time the whale feeds. And what scientists have figured out is that there's a sidedness to how they do it. Whales tend to feed on one side or another. And so we interpret that to be handedness, even though they don't really have hands. They have flippers.
Right.
That's sort of not surprising. We know that there's handedness in other species that are not us out there in the world.
Yeah.
But I think that's surprising for whales because they don't have opposable thumbs.
Right? For sure.
So how are they doing that? And that's largely inferred from how they're moving in their environment.
Yeah, really, really interesting. All right, let's get a caller involved in the conversation as well. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Nick Pyenson.
Yeah, hey, real fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being on Duncan's show. 2 weekends ago at a vegan festival in Tampa, I met Duncan, who's an amazing guy in the helping and educating about animals media industry, and also heard Dr. Paul Watson, the man who I think single-handedly, along with his crew, are doing the most real things that stop the destruction of whales. And I'd like for you to comment on all the many threats under the umbrella of anthropogenic mass extinction, military exercises using sonar, fishing of all kinds, including small boat fishing, pollution, habitat loss, all the things that are making, that could make it where if there was a person like yourself, 500 years from now, they'd look and see mostly fossil whales and hardly any live ones because of us.
All right. Thanks for your call and thanks for your nice comment. Dr.
Pines. Yeah, there's a lot wrapped up in that comment. And I think that is in large part because whales live in a complex world nowadays, in large part because of our own actions. So just stepping back a few hundred years, whales were far more abundant. All the species of whales, all the 80-some species of whales, were far more abundant. In other words, their populations were much larger in the historical past than they are today. And that's in large part because of whaling in many different ways, many different kinds of whaling, whether it's nearshore whaling or pelagic whaling offshore. In the 20th century alone, whaling in the southern hemisphere killed nearly 2 million whales. So today, circa 2018, we live in a world with far fewer whales than historically was true. Many populations of large whales have been dropped down to 5% of where they started over 100 years ago. So this has effects on their genetic diversity. It certainly has an effect on how frequently we see them, and it has an effect on their recovery, especially if these whales have to feed in environments that overlap with our own. And a great example of that is the North Atlantic right whale. If you live on the eastern seaboard of the United States, this is one of the most endangered species of whales on the planet. There may only be 400 left, and they have not been whaled in over 100 years, maybe 120 years. Yet they still have not really recovered. And that's been a puzzle to whale biologists who are interested in their conservation. And it's been exacerbated because North Atlantic right whales feed in the same environment where there's shipping and fishing. And both of those have direct impacts on their mortalities. In other words, right whales end up being struck by cargo ships, by cruise ships, and they get entangled in fishermen's lines. Both those effects can either kill them directly or just prolong their agony. We realize now this is a huge problem because last year, the last breeding season, there were no new calves observed of North Atlantic right whales, and we lost 17 of them to a variety of ship strike and entanglement. So that's a source of concern. If you just wind the clock forward in the future, if you're not reproducing and suffering more mortalities, your population is going to drop. This is even much more a concern for geographically restricted species. You may have heard about the vaquita, this small species of porpoise that only lives in the Gulf of California in Mexico. And so there's maybe fewer than a dozen left. And what we do in those situations is not really clear. Do we try to pen them off in large pens at sea to keep them in sort of semi-captivity until we can safeguard their habitat? What exactly do we do in those situations for large mammals that live over large areas? So there's a number of human threats. Today, I think whaling is far smaller of a threat than fishing. Many hundreds of thousands of whales, so that includes species of dolphins and larger whales, are hurt by the side effects of fishing, whether it's bycatch or entanglement in lines. So we kind of know what the impact is of humans on whales today. Now, what are we going to do about it? I think that's a question that takes you out of science and into the realm of economics and politics, and that's where everybody's voice matters. You know, what scientists tell us is important, but also how we act about it. I think the question of whether or not there will be whales in 400 years, I think that's pretty clear that some whales will do okay in planet Earth in the age of humans. Humpback whales, gray whales, they seem to have flexible enough strategies for feeding and for how they live that keeps them mostly out of harm's way. And part of that has to do with the fact that there's humpbacks all around the world. They're not geographically restricted the way that the vaquita is or river dolphin might be. But we do know the kinds of species that are really threatened by human activities. And so that should be where I think most of our concern should be located.
Okay, good. That's great. And yeah, it's coincidentally, with our caller mentioning Captain Watson not too long ago, I spoke with Captain Watson again on this show, and one of the things we talked about was the vaquitas and how they have a campaign there, but just how the numbers are so small. And I asked him, I said, "What is there something that can be done to sort of stave this off and or to restore the population?" And he didn't sound too optimistic, just because he said, if you start to do anything in sort of captivity or semi-captivity, I'm never a fan of that. Not sure that yields any results in terms of anything to encourage breeding. He just said, just sort of feel like species should be left alone. But boy, the numbers are so low now, it's hard to feel optimistic about rebounding.
I guess it's a good topic to pick up on two items. I think I would be, one, I think we do have to, I mean, this is my personal opinion. It's not, basis. It's my opinion as a scientist, but I think we do see many cases where we do get involved. This question of whether we should or not is not a scientific question. That's a social question.
Yeah.
It's a moral question about getting intervening
in the
species. And I think sometimes we feel as though we should, given our history of interactions. And for the vaquita, scientists have made it very clear for over 20 years that that population, the only population of that species that's found nowhere else, has been on the decline for clear reasons associated with fishing for a very large fish that also lives in the Gulf of California, the totoaba.
Yeah.
And so it's not like scientists have been befuddled by what's causing their decline. Now, as a paleontologist, I definitely tend to fall on the pessimistic side of conservation. But I think in the vaquita, that has continued to surprise us. For one, it looks like conservation of vaquita is going to be very hard. That porpoises don't do well in captivity.
Yeah.
And the vaquita seems to be like that. But this is, I think, last month, there's the first photo documentation of several individuals that are still around in the Gulf of California. And the vaquita is notoriously difficult to document. These are very, these are species that you just don't see that much. And
yeah,
the fact that there are photos and video of several individuals, including a calf, I think gives us a lot of hope.
Yeah.
I actually thought a year ago that there would be no more vaquita circa fall 2018. But the fact that we do know that they're still out there, I'm actually pretty hopeful.
Oh, that's great.
Great. You know, it's not, they're not out of the woods by any means.
No, but when you say you saw a picture of an image of a calf right away, that's just that one calf is practically cause for celebration, given the numbers being as incredibly low as they are.
Absolutely. We know that every individual matters, and we've brought species back from the brink several times before. I think it's just a matter of our political and economic will and our creativity as conservationists.
Again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Nick Pyonson, a paleontologist and author of Spying on Whales, The Past, Present, and Future of Earth's Most Awesome Creatures. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. One of our emailers, by the way, said the subject line is lunge feeding. It says, "Hi, great guest. I just saw a video of a whale lunge feeding from underwater. It was so incredible. Just had to say that. Thanks." So that's that. So you're mentioning humpback whales. Now, in the opening of the book, you sketch a scene where you're near the Antarctic Peninsula doing field study on humpback whales that are, of course, very much alive and well. You've kind of touched on this, obviously, already, but explain why it's important for a paleontologist, or at least for you as a paleontologist, to be out in the field engaging in that sort of research.
So for one, it goes back to that aspect of science being collaborative. There's no one person who can answer all the questions or can know enough to answer all those questions. So the fact that you need collaborators immediately puts you out in the field, puts you out in a larger group of people. Now, the reason to go out in the field for me is that I think there's nothing like seeing the organism that you study, and this is speaking as somebody who works on museum collections for much of the day, to really understand questions about how they are today, because that's the question of how they are today is the natural counterpoint to where they came from. How are they? Where did they come from? Those are the two basic questions you might want to ask as a biologist. Understanding that, like I said, it's the rubber where the rubber meets the road for that organism requires seeing them in the wild. Now, that's really a challenge. It's a huge logistical challenge for whales. If you go out on a whale watch, you might see them blow, you might see them breach, but that's only a fraction of the time of their lives underwater. And what they're doing ecologically, what's the most important function, is happening underwater. So getting that tag data is really important. And understanding what kind of data you can get. I mean, that's a very visceral thing. That requires being side by side. It actually requires sitting with the scientist and seeing how they work over a prolonged period of time, how you collect those data, what do they mean, how do you interpret them. It's taken me years to acquire that knowledge about how we know that for living whales, and that includes both bench work, lab work, getting out in the field. So I think one of your questions was, you know, there's a wide range. I think people would be surprised reading the book to see the wide range of kinds of studies that you get involved with once you start asking these questions. I think that's a natural thing if you understand that these questions cut across boundaries, that we all are scientists with specialties, with who we spent years kind of developing a specialized set of knowledge. But really, the big questions cut across those disciplines. And that goes back to doing science as a team, which is a lot of fun.
So, Dr. Pyonson, how commonplace then is, again, the range of activities that you undertake, including, again, all the field studies, et cetera, how commonplace is that among your paleontologist peers?
Oh, I hope it becomes more common. I think you lose sight of what the important parts are of what you study if you become too narrowly focused on one branch of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that it's easy to become a specialist. I mean, that's why people go to graduate school, spend years gaining a mastery of one set of skills or one set of specialized knowledge. But that's, again, the world is hugely complex. The fact that we don't even really know how many species of whales there are on the planet, the fact that we don't really know the anatomy of most of those whales or their life history, you know, or what they really feed on, there's so many questions that are out there. That always makes me think that, you know, we actually have to be, as scientists, pretty careful about the amount of time we spend on any given project, because there's just going to be so many more mysteries than you'll ever able to solve. But again, that makes me hopeful, because that's why working with students and training the next generation of scientists is really important to me.
That's great. Well, we're in our final few minutes, but I have other questions. There's at least one more email question I want to ask. But one thing I absolutely need to get to is because arguably the heart, if not the soul of the book, involves your recounting your realization that an area of Chile housed dozens of complete whale skeletons, a bonanza, as you describe it, pretty much wholly unprecedented in your career. But there was also a ticking clock element to unearthing the skeletons, and it was all very cinematic and exhilarating in the book. Can you walk us through at least just a little abbreviated summary of that experience?
Yeah, this is a good example of serendipity in science. You never really know when an opportunity might crop up. It really changes the direction of your research in a big way. And we were already working in Chile with a large group of collaborators of Chilean scientists and scientists from North America to understand what the fossil record of this part of the Atacama meant for how the Humboldt current system got started in the first place. This is a tremendously productive ocean ecosystem, and the record of the large-bodied predators that live in it, so whales, sharks, seals, and many other extinct predators, is all recorded in these desert rock deposits. So we were working there, and all of a sudden, and it's for reasons of geopolitics, an excavation along the side of the Pan American Highway exposed 1, 2, 3, and then it became many more whale skeletons. And it took one of my colleagues, somebody who was maybe an unreliable narrator. You know, you may have friends who embellish stories. And he kept on telling me about the site, and I didn't really believe him, much to my chagrin, until we got to the site and saw all the whale skeletons that were preserved at what became Cerro Ballena. And the ticking clock element was we had very little time to study them as they were being excavated out of the ground and brought to a local natural history museum. And, you know, when you realize the scope of the site, that there were some 40 skeletons of fossil whales, in many cases preserved nose to tip, your immediate question is what happened here and why? And to answer that question, we needed data that provide us with that context of the skeletons. And if you're removing the skeletons from the ground quickly to make room for mining equipment and another lane of highway, you're going to miss out on that information. And that's where we brought new technological tools, 3D digitization, to the site to scan and photograph and document the entire context of these whale skeletons. And that context is ultimately what helped us answer why. What's going on at Cerro Ballena.
And speaking of context, just for people listening who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, since you mentioned there were some 40 whale skeletons, I think somewhere in the book, as you were first hearing about this or starting to get the realization that your friend, who you may have doubted at first, actually was really onto something, I think you said at some point that up to that point, at least in your career, you had maybe seen one whale skeleton at that level. So the idea that suddenly there was 40 was truly hitting the paleontological lotto of some kind.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing I didn't really believe. And as I came to accept it, I also realized the scope of the task before me. You know, and that was I was lucky that I had a team of people to help me work through that. And I think that's a good example of, you know, the consequence of serendipity in science. If you decide to seize the opportunity, you want to make sure that you actually deliver, that you actually do the science and figure out the answer to your question. Because that doesn't really happen every day, that kind of opportunity.
Well, we're almost out of time, Dr. Pineson, but I want to get a quick question in from an emailer and hopefully at least one more quick question of my own. But the emailer says, is there hope for the narwhal with global warming?
Oh, that's a great question. So the Arctic is changing faster than, the poles are changing faster than the rest of the planet because of global climate change, because they're warming faster. And what that, in large part, that may mean in a decade or two, we'll see a very different Arctic than the Arctic that I remember, the Arctic that most of the world's population was born into. And that means an Arctic that is more like an open ocean and less like a frozen one. So for narwhals that are adapted to Arctic environments, what does that mean for them? I think it means that they will definitely be harassed and maybe chased and become prey of killer whales and other invaders from warmer waters. We know that's already happening. There's a lot of documentation about that already. I don't know. I'm hopeful that many species in the Arctic, especially whale species, will be able to adapt to these changes because they largely mean more productivity and more food as the Arctic becomes more like an open ocean, less like an Arctic, less like a frozen one. But what I'm worried about is the human footprint in the Arctic. If the Arctic melts, it becomes a shipping lane much more easily. And that means more humans, more chances for unfortunate events, oil spills, ship strikes, more people, more pollution. So I think the Arctic is really ground zero for all these concerns about climate change and conservation.
All right. Well, and of course, now I have about a minute left, so I'm asking you, of course, a more introspective, philosophical-minded question in that remaining time. But at one point you write that you hope the book says as much about the inner lives of scientists as it does about whales. So with now some pretty sizable distance from when you wrote the book, what do you think it says about your inner life?
Oh, wow. I hope it reveals that scientists are people just like your next door neighbor. They have these opportunities to investigate really amazing aspects about the world, but they have the same challenges and the same setbacks that anybody else does in their job. But I think that's important for understanding how science works. That's really the key thing. Is science is a way of knowing, and it can tell us amazing things about big mysteries out there, whether it's about whales, whether it's about cosmology and the origin of the universe, or the organisms in your backyard. All those things are can be tremendously exciting and interesting and worthy of your time.
Great. Well, that's the perfect point, I think, at which to leave it. We've been speaking with Dr. Nick Pynson. Again, his book is Spying on Whales, The Past, Present, and Future of Earth's Most Awesome Creatures. Wherever you get your book, you can get this one. And as I hope our conversation suggested, it's just fascinating in all kinds of ways, large and small. And there's all kinds of things we didn't even get a chance to touch on, but we covered at least, I think, some key elements. So, Dr. Pynson, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You bet. In a few moments, I'll speak with Don Goldstein about the key things to consider in the wake of Amendment 13 passing, particularly a clearer picture of what will happen to the dogs as racing is phased out by 2020. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is longtime fave Brian Regan with a piece very much tied to our conversation with Dr. Pynson. This is Whale Noises by Brian Regan, today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I saw this documentary recently on whales. This guy has dedicated his life to telling you what the whales are saying. Wow. I don't know how you'd argue with him when he turns in his report. And he just throws it down there. Well, here's what the whales are saying. Okay, thanks, Charlie. He's looking back. Here's what the whales are saying. Yeah, Charlie figured it out. They show how he does it. He's out on a ship, he's got a pencil, and he deciphers the whale noises as he hears them. You know, he'll hear like, you know, he's like, oh, okay. Oh, he's lonely. No, you're lonely. How'd you like to do that for like 2 weeks and then turn around and find out that the door's squeaking behind you?
That was Brian Regan with a piece called Whale Noises, taken from his album simply entitled Live. Now it's time to speak with Don Goldstein about the aftermath of Amendment 13 passing, particularly what will become of the Greyhounds as racing ends by 2020. This is Don Goldstein back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us from Colorado, no less, to have our little chat here today. So, first of all, congratulations to you and others who worked tirelessly on passing Amendment 13.
It was a wonderful victory for about 800 very dedicated volunteers.
Yeah. So the questions I kind of keep seeing swirling around that I was hoping you might focus on today is what really does happen with the dogs? I mean, under the terms of the amendment, racing does get phased out over time, so by 2020, but what happens to the dogs and what sort of provisions have been made for them?
Well, basically nothing happens until after the first of the year, and that's decoupling occurs. So that means that racetracks, the dog tracks, do not have to run races in order to keep their card rooms open. So that's the first big change. It's called decoupling, and we've talked about that a number of times over the years.
Yeah.
So some of the dogs will become available at this point. The concerns about the dogs themselves is understandable. People are fearful of dogs being injured or even euthanized. Jim Gartland, who is the executive director of the NGA, the National Greyhound Association, says that they will ensure that no dogs are harmed as a result of Amendment 13. Having said that, they've also said that they will not give greyhounds to any of groups that supported Amendment 13. We suspect that may have to change after when they realize there's just not enough groups that were against Amendment 13 to handle all the dogs.
And Don, sorry to interrupt, but is that as punitive as it sounds?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. It's
okay.
As simple as that.
Okay.
But we don't know the actual number of dogs. The state doesn't control that. They don't tally that. You know, last June there was about 3,700 dogs racing in the state of Florida. There are some at the farms. We know that a lot of the larger farms in Florida have closed over the last couple of years. They're not breeding as many. They're keeping the dogs longer at the track. We assume that's probably because they thought Amendment 13 might pass. So we really don't have a good handle on the number of dogs. The industry's throwing out the number of 8,000 at the tracks and 7,000 at farms. We know that's not the case. So we're just going to have to kind of wait and see. The owners own the dogs, and it's kind of up to them what they do with them.
Yeah.
A good share, some of them will go to the six remaining tracks in the other states. Some will be adopted out, for sure. But the thing to remember is that we phase this out. It phases out over a six-month period, now 5.5 months. So that gives time for these dogs to be absorbed into the adoption community. And considering that most racing greyhounds are done before they're 3 years old, the dogs that are currently racing, and for the most part even in the pipeline, would have needed homes anyway by the December 31st of 2020. So it's not as big a burden on the adopt group as it may seem at first blush.
So is this issue then, if not a false issue, a little bit kind of exaggerated just by people who are still maybe peeved that the vote went the way it did?
Yes, we think so. The emotions are still very high.
Yeah.
We understand people lose their jobs, and we don't feel good about that, but their jobs were based basically on what we think was inhumane treatment of animals.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of other people have lost jobs. When was the last time you saw somebody install a payphone?
That's true. Yeah. All right. So it sounds like really the way it's designed and just the way the nature of greyhounds and greyhound racing careers are that it's pretty well squared away. So there isn't really cause for alarm. And some of the more dire scenarios that you hear or read now and again aren't really likely to play out.
There's some rumors floating around about dogs being euthanized even now. We don't think they're true. We have no evidence that it is true. It's just rumors.
Yeah.
We think it's coming out of the emotion of the election. As time passes and the emotion subsides, I think we're going to find that the greyhounds are going to find loving homes.
Okay. Well, that sounds like exactly how it should be. So.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And Duncan, I want to personally thank you for your support of this. It's been super, and I mean, that goes back way before Proposition 67 or Amendment 13.
Yeah, well, you and I have been talking on this show for feels like a number of years, and so it's nice to see the outcome, what it turned out to be on Election Day, especially in light of some of the things that happened, even notwithstanding recounts. So,
absolutely.
So I appreciate that. Any we just have a few seconds left on anything else just by way of Amendment 13 or overall that you'd like to add?
Well, I'm just proud of the voters of Florida just to see the reality of the racing. And when nearly 70% voted for this amendment, it was very heartwarming.
Yeah, great. Okay, cool. Well, Don, thanks once again for joining us and making time while you're trying to otherwise enjoy time with family. And we'll keep tabs and see what else we need to update folks on as we move along here towards 2020.
Thanks, Duncan. I hope you, your family, and all of your listeners have a wonderful and safe Thanksgiving.
Great. Likewise. Thanks, Don. Bye-bye. We have reached the end of Talking Animals Just About. Rob Loria is up next with Radioactivity, and I'll be back next week with another show. You can check everything out on talkinganimals.net, links to social media, etc., information about the show, archives of everything we've ever done. It's WMNF Tampa.